And we're live.
Hello, and welcome back to another, it's pronounced Averill, not Haverhill, episode of the First Time Watchers podcast.
Because we like to watch.
My name is Tim Costa.
I'm Hermano Da Silva.
And this is Walter Vinci.
What we'd like to do on the FTW podcast is find a movie that none of us have seen, watch it together, and then discuss. These movies could be new, they could be old, or something that is on all of our lists of shame. And remember to email us at firsttimewatchers@gmail.com, and stay tuned to the end of this episode for other ways to contact us, and to find out what we'll be discussing next week. Speaking of feedback, I'd like to thank Neil Ramji for sending his feedback on Twitter, saying that he enjoyed our Sleepless Night episode in his car trip, and he says, man, Hermano has a mean streak. Does sound like a crap film, though.
Wow, Hermano can't catch a break on this one.
Right on both times.
Both
counts.
No, Hermano's
vindicated. He's agreeing with me.
He's vindicated.
That this sounds like a crap film.
Oh, that's right. I had the movies backwards. I was thinking Headhunters again.
Yeah.
I had it backwards. I was like, oh,
don't
no.
you dare put those in the same thought.
In this episode, we will be talking about the latest Brad Pitt film, Killing Them Softly. But before we get into that, it's time for Yay or Nay. Yay! This is the part of the show where we discuss what we have seen recently on our own. Walter?
All right. Well, I saw in Japanese animated movie called Paprika, which was actually pretty awesome. It is crazy and it has to deal with, it deals with dreaming. It's something that very much like if Christopher Nolan lost his marbles while making Inception, he would probably could have made this movie. It's kind of like they took parts of Inception and they took parts of The Cell. Because it's actually a device that allows people to actually jump into dreams and do, like, dream therapy.
What would you say Inception took parts from Paprika?
This is... Because which came
2006,
first? 2006. Oh, I didn't catch the Paprika came out. So maybe Inception took some of the ideas from them, and maybe some... Paprika took some of the ideas from The Cell, which I did not like. But it has to do with this technology that allows people to jump into your dreams so that they can... psychotherapists can analyze you. But someone has gotten a hold of this and is... essentially weaponized it so that you can make people who are awake think that they're dreaming. So you could be like walking on the street all of a sudden and see something crazy, and then you know you look like you're trying to escape, say like a monster, and you throw yourself off a balcony because you think it's just like a regular fence. The visuals in this movie are actually pretty insane, and there's some really clever elements to it that I sat there and thought, well, this is actually really cool. And I can see where, you know, Inception probably could have gotten some of its elements from. There's a part where the cop who's trying to solve investigate a murder, and he is every time he has this dream, he has this recurring dream where he's in a circus, and then he's swinging from a vine like Tarzan, and he's being choked by a guy with a cable, and then he's at like a 1930s horse race, and he keeps going through all these things, and then he's in a hallway, and someone's being like the victim is slowly falling like after he's been shot in front of him. That's actually one of the side stories that's going on. But overall, this movie is actually a lot of fun to watch.
Hermano, you've seen this, right?
I've seen it a while back. I remember the thing that attracted me to it was just the animation style. The animation style is amazing. It's really, really unique looking. And I don't remember that much about it as far as story, but everything Wally's saying is right on as far as... you know what I remember from it.
Yeah, it doesn't look like your typical anime movie. It, you know, the characters don't have big eyes and little small mouths. They're actually proportionately drawn. They look like somebody actually like, you know, spent a lot of time like actually constructing these figures instead of exaggerated, you know, limbs and all that. And the dream sequence are actually a lot of fun because like whenever someone's caught in a dream, they're stuck in this parade full of like refrigerators and radios and dressers and wind up toys and ceramic dolls, and they get caught up in this parade as it goes along. It's actually really cool.
This is the kind of anime that I could never see myself being like, okay, I'll watch this right now.
Oh, it's good.
I don't know.
So this is a yay all the way.
Fair enough. Next.
Next is kind of a compare and contrast. Christopher Sparling wrote two movies that I watched recently. One called Buried, starring Ryan Reynolds.
Which came out in 2010.
And one called ATM.
Which came out earlier this year.
Okay. Buried. Is yay.
Agreed.
I watched it... last night, and it was excellent. And I was like, wow, this is, like, really intense. I mean, I disagree with some of the things that maybe, you know, the character does in the movie. When an opportunity is presented to him, I was like, well, here's your chance!
Well, he's not really going to make chances.
Well,
considering his circumstance.
I can't say much about this movie without spoiling anything. But there's a part. Well, I'll talk to you off the air, and I'll explain what I'm referring to. Then there's ATM, which is utter shit.
Oh, really?
By comparison, it is three people trapped in an ATM by one man with a crowbar, and he will chase them only so far up to the ATM, and then he'll stop and he'll just let them, you know, stay in there. And there's all sorts of holes with this, with the problem, like story problems, with the continuity problems and story problems with this whole thing.
Now, you had mentioned they're written by the same person, but they're directed
two different
by,
two different directors.
Do you think it's more of a problem with the direction or the writing?
If it depends on how much of the script was actually interpreted by the director, because in Buried, it's a very tight, it seems like a very tight story, like a person trapped and can't get out, you know, trying to find ways to free himself. In this, these people are trapped in an ATM. You know, all they essentially would have to do is either A, wait, and or B, three of them. There are three of them. There's only one of this guy. They can run separate directions, you know, and get the hell away from this dude. But then there's all these like other like just stupid things that happen in the movie. Like the killer kills a man walking his dog at the beginning of the movie for no readily apparent reason. He just beats him to death, and then later on. Kills a security guard who's like a rent-a-cop who comes to investigate and sees him. He's about to call for help when he sees that the kids are trapped, and he gets killed.
Of course.
But then some guy who's dressed exactly like the serial killer gets to walk into the ATM. Like, he doesn't kill him. You know what I mean? Like, this is that. Like, he's outside circling, making sure no one comes near this
interesting
thing.
Hey, did you ever see a movie called, was it Frozen, where people are stuck on a ski lift?
I've never seen it, but I know what you're talking
about. It sounds very similar to a combination of these two movies and The Grey.
Even close. I wouldn't even put it anywhere near that.
But no, I'm talking about Frozen, the movie Frozen. So I recommend you go see that next.
Isn't Frozen by the same guys who did Open Water?
I think so. Now that you mention it, I think so. I'm not positive.
But yeah, ATM is just is shit. It's a complete nay. The villain is stupid, and then when you expect some sort of payoff as to like what the villain's motivation is, you don't get it. He just retreats and just finds another map, and is like, okay, there's cameras here. Maybe I'll do something crazy. No motivation for a villain. And some of the stuff like the characters, you're like, this is just stupid. You guys could just either wait it out, run away. You have all these choices, but no.
But Buried is a yay.
Buried is a yay.
Yeah.
Certainly Buried is a yay. ATM, nay.
By the way, Frozen, not by the guys that did Open Water. It was the guys that did Hatchet.
All right, right on. So maybe I would see that then.
Okay. Is that all for you?
That's all I got.
All right, I'll go next. I'll first talk about a Michael Haneke film called Cachet. That's the French title. In English, it's called Hidden. From 2005, now this is the second Michael Haneke film I've seen, the other one being Funny Games, the original, because I know he remade it with Naomi Watts, I believe.
Yep. Yes.
You both have seen those?
No, I refuse to see that game movie.
Oh.
I've seen the remake.
You've seen the remake. I've not seen the original. But from what I gather, the remake is exactly the same as the original, just in English.
Also what I've heard, yep.
Okay. Now, going back to Funny Games, I saw the original version, and that movie is fucked up. And as is Cachet, not to the same degree, but what I've gathered from Michael Haneke in seeing two of his films is that he does not like himself or his audience. He has no regard for the feelings of the audience whatsoever, and that he is willing to punish the audience just for watching the film, apparently. That's the only reason I can even think of why he does this to the audience, because I can understand with Cachet, I had to go into the special features and watch a little bit of his interview to see what the point of the story was. The plot is a married couple is terrorized by a series of surveillance videotapes left on their front porch, and at first it's just videotapes of their house for like 2 hours straight, just recording a stationary camera positioned on their street looking at their house. Nothing else. That's it. And they're wondering what's up with this. And then later it's they're given more videotapes, but they have like childlike menacing drawings on them, like a childlike drawing of a person throwing up blood, or then a chicken with its head cut off. So this leads to the husband realizing that, hey, this actually might be somebody from my past, but he keeps his wife at the distance because he doesn't want his wife to get more worried. But that all this leads to more complications between the couple, and tensions rising between the couple, and trust issues. And I mean, there's a moment in here which is utterly breathtaking in its shock value, but. This is a movie that has no ending. This would infuriate you, Ollie, because it has no ending whatsoever. You think it's going to go somewhere, but it literally just stops there. And the movie itself keeps on going, but there's still no ending. There's no resolution. I kind of get the point of it, but it'll stay with you. It'll stick with you. It's pretty disturbing. It's not going to stick with me as much as Funny Games did, because that movie I compare the ending of that movie to the ending of The Mist and how it punishes you.
I think Funny Games is worse because they do something in the movie towards the end that completely takes you out of the movie and at the same time pisses you off, because
you appreciate the balls that he has to do it, though.
No, yeah, and I've read interviews with people that are close to him, or maybe it was from him directly, saying that he doesn't go out for happy endings. Like he wants to make the audience feel something other than like joy. He gets off a little bit on punishing.
Obviously he does, because I was looking at his filmography and I'm like, he must be a masochist of some sort, because he must hate himself and life, and therefore doesn't want anybody else to enjoy anything. That's the only thing I can see why he puts his audience in the characters in the movies through this. So Caché, I'd have to give a meh, because it's not for everybody and it's just effed up. Next, I will talk about The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. Now, once again, I'm going through the trilogy to lead up to The Hobbit, and this is a really interesting film, especially, obviously, when you compare it to the first one, because in the first one, they set up the characters, the main characters that you're going to follow throughout the whole trilogy. And the second one, it really gives you a sense of the scope and the scale of all of Middle Earth and everybody involved in Middle Earth, like how the One Ring affects everybody, you know, and every race and every region of Middle Earth. And it's really striking that way. Everybody's seen this movie, so there's not much I have to talk about. So, of course, it's a yay. Next is a wonderful little British television show from 1999 and 2001 called Spaced. This is starring Simon Pegg and Jessica Hines, and they wrote every single episode. There's only 14 total episodes, 7 in each season. And Wally, you've seen this, right?
I haven't seen it in a while, but I remember seeing it a while back.
Oh, Hermano, you'd love this.
It is really funny.
This is right up our alleys, as our generation's alleys, because it is like kind of like Family Guy, like a live action Family Guy or The Simpsons, in which they have a lot of flashbacks or flash forwards and pop culture references up the wazoo. And it is so wonderfully written. Directed by Edgar Wright of Hot Fuzz and fame, and
Scott Pilgrim,
that's right, and Shaun of the Dead.
Yep.
So you know, this is, I guess, you know, their big break, this British television show, and they make the most out of the limited budget they have, because you can tell this is a really low budget story. It's two friends, Tim and Daisy, who are 30-something new North Londoners with uncertain futures, must pretend to be a couple to live in the only apartment that they can afford. And it's in this house that, you know, the landlord is a lady, the middle-aged lady that lives there, and there's a pseudo kind of relationship with the troubled artist that lives in the basement apartment.
Yep.
and he is, so every character in this show is so funny, and there's only a few characters. Nick Frost plays this militaristic hungry guy who had been kicked out of the volunteer military. And he's like the survivalist nut too. But the interactions between everybody, the references that are thrown out, it's just a wonderful, wonderful show. It is really amazing. I actually gave it 5 stars on Netflix. It's awesome.
Whoa.
Yes. So Spaced, that's a yay all the way. And finally, I want to talk about Boardwalk Empire, because season 3 just ended, and I know I've talked about the show in the past, but this show, this season was effing amazing, because it once again followed on to the stories that, some plot lines that were, left over from season 2, and how they continue it, and there's one gangster that was presented in this season called, his name was Jip Rossetti, played by Bobby Cannavale. I swear to God, he deserves an Emmy nomination for his role, because he plays this most menacing, evil gangster that you just have no idea, like all the characters that get involved with him have no idea how to act or react around him. He's so great, so well written, and so well played by this guy. One thing I was disappointed about, especially in the second half of the season, was not enough Michael Shannon, because he played this former FBI agent who's on the run because he committed some crimes, and he actually gets involved in his own home distillery with his runaway girlfriend / bride, and he starts getting turned into the criminal underworld, and it's a great little twist, but not enough of him in the second half. He just kind of disappeared, and I was really disappointed about that. Steve Buscemi, of course, is great as Nucky Thompson, this is just a fantastic show that I've seen from the beginning. It's really, really well done, well written. So that's a yay for Boardwalk Empire. Hermano.
Okay, so the first thing I watched was a documentary called Happy. This is basically a documentary pretty much examining what it is that makes certain people happy and other people unhappy. And in the documentary, they get into scientific studies of the human brain and different like kind of receptors that activate when you're happy, and just like the chemical changes that go on in your brain when you're happy. And then they also go on to study different types of people, like lower class, middle class, and just kind of study them for a little bit and kind of get to know a little bit about them and what it is they do. And these people, and they study like one person, I think he's like in Calcutta or something, and this guy barely has anything. Like he lives in a house that's pretty much like a wooden frame with a tarp over it.
Hmm.
And he has a giant family, parents that live with him. He has like 4 kids. He just pushes a rickshaw all day, but yet he's like the happiest guy in the world, and he couldn't ask for anything more. Like he's just perfectly content with what he does, and he loves his family, and he's completely happy. And then they also try to study a little bit like upper middle class to the rich. And I think if there was one fault to this documentary is that they don't really get too much into that aspect of happiness, like where they try to study the rich and see if all it takes for them to be happy is money. And they try to do some studies where they find that it tends to be that rich people are the most unhappy in the world, because money alone, doesn't buy them happiness. And maybe it's because they have that many more, P. Diddy used to say, more money, more problems.
I remember that.
Yeah, remember that.
Yep.
Who's P. Diddy?
Puffy Combs. You might remember him from the 90s.
What other names has he used before?
I don't know. whatever. But basically, in a documentary, I'll say meh because I think they do lean a little bit too much in on the side of like, hey, look at all these people. You know, they have very little, yet they're extremely happy. And you know, it doesn't get too scientific. They talk to a few people whose main study is I forget what they call it, but it's just the study of happiness, I guess. And it's not poorly done. I'm struggling with giving it a yay because it isn't very long. It's not a long watch. It's like an hour and 16 minutes.
It's only 76 minutes, so that must have made you happy.
It did. Nice segue.
That's what they did there.
So I'll say meh for now. It's not terrible. You could absolutely do worse than watching it. But yeah, I'll stick with meh. Next, I watched in the continuing of you know, shortening my list of shame. I watched another Alfred Hitchcock movie called Lifeboat. Wally has seen it.
I have not seen this for shame.
Tim has not seen it. I liked it. I think of the ones I hadn't seen of Alfred Hitchcock's movies, I think this is maybe my least favorite.
I believe this is actually one of his first movies, if not his first movie.
It's no, one of it's his not, earlier
it's
ones.
It's 1944. Yeah. He did plenty of movies before then.
Really? I thought he started like in 41 or something.
No,
like
he
that.
Started in the 20s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, regardless, the movie is about a bunch of survivors that...
First movie, The Pleasure Garden, 1925. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, I don't have IMDb in front of me, Tim. Anyway, basically the movie's about a lifeboat.
Really?
And that's it.
Ooh.
No, I'm just kidding. It's about... It takes place during World War II, and an American ship has just been sunk, and a bunch of survivors hop onto a lifeboat. At the same time, that American ship took down a German ship, and a Nazi officer also hops onto the ship. And the movie goes from there as to, you know, some people are on the side of, hey, you know, we're people, let's take him as a prisoner of war. Some of the soldier survivors want to just toss him overboard and say, you know, F this dude. I thought the movie could have gone maybe in a certain direction where, I don't know, it seemed like for a large part of the movie, nothing really was happening. It was just kind of like... you know, discussing, you know, what are we going to do about food? What are we going to do about water? There wasn't so much an element of distrust, but it does start to happen. And the German soldier seems to be the most knowledgeable as far as which direction they should be going. He was actually, it's revealed he's, I shouldn't reveal this, but I think the biggest problem I had with this movie, and Wally might, I don't know if he remembers the end, but I thought there was a huge opportunity in the end to do something like sort of like a twist that I thought would have been brilliant.
And then they missed it.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
All right. I thought it was a huge opportunity. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I totally thought that's where they were going. And when it didn't, I was kind of like, I was like, okay. I mean, that's fine. They went the other way. I definitely don't think the movie's bad. It definitely feels like many of his movies from the 40s where they felt like this, they're filmed on sound stages or on, you know, in a theater, and they just have like a backdrop of an ocean, you know what I mean? But there are some things that happen towards the end of the film that I thought looked pretty damn good, considering it's from 1944. I would definitely say yay on this. Even his, you know, movies that I don't, you know, appreciate as much, I still think they're pretty fantastic. So I definitely say yay and check it out. And for my mystery movie, I saw probably the most important movie I've seen all year. Nothing else has come close to this movie for me. Tim will absolutely not find this on IMDb. You will barely even find it on the internet.
What the hell?
When I saw it, I actually saw it on VHS. It's that old and that unavailable. Part of my Lamaze class, I saw a movie called Hello Baby.
Really?
It's basically, it's a movie about... for parents, and what to know, you know, when your woman goes into labor.
Basically, at what point did you go, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god,
I'm not going to be on that end?
This movie blew my mind.
I can imagine.
Because I thought this was going to be like rated G, I'm just going to, you know, get a kind of, you know, a few, like, you know, some dude, just doctor guy talking to me.
Had you never seen a live birth before, like on video or anything?
I have, but I just didn't think this movie was going to be it, because this movie looks like it's from the late 70s, maybe early 80s.
Okay.
Based on just, you know, the hairstyles and...
You must have felt like you were back in school with her wheeling in the set. Car.
When she busted out the VHS, I was like... They don't have this on DVD, and somebody actually asked, and yeah, they don't. They never, but apparently, this is one of the best, like, you know, instructional like videos as far as to what to expect when, you know, in labor, and it kind of gives you three different viewpoints of different types of personalities of women. Like, there's the first woman just handles the birth like nothing, like a champ, no medicine, no any kind of anesthesia, nothing, just. Totally content the whole time. Baby pops out. She's like, yay. The second lady is kind of in between. Like, she's kind of, like, really, you know, kind of whiny and, like, you know,
Do they show them in labor before the birth and stuff like that?
They show pretty much everything. They leave nothing to the imagination.
No, I mean, do they establish what their personalities are like before they
show them in labor? Sort of. You get to meet them very briefly, and then it goes right to the delivery room, and you see everything. The camera goes right in. You see the baby coming out, and I'm just like,
"What? I wish you could. I wish the viewers could see Dr. Romano's face."
Dude, we're in a Lamaze class. I'm thinking, I'm surrounded by other pregnant women and stuff like that, and I'm like, okay, so I'm just like, you know, this is going to be some guy like Trent McClure on fucking The Simpsons, just like, so this is what you should expect, and blah blah blah, and like right away it just goes like, woman spread eagle, baby coming out, and I'm like, whoa. So, you know, the second lady, she deals with it a little bit more roughly. The third lady, she has actually, I forget what it's called now, but it's when the baby's face is actually breached. Facing your spine.
Breached?
It's not called breach. Breach is when the baby's, like,
folded in half.
It's folded in half and it's facing, its head is up instead of down. But, you know, like I said, it's the most important movie I've seen all year. It's very, very informative. I feel like I learned a lot.
I just picture you sitting there in your class, and then your skull opens up like that Old Spice commercial, and your brain goes, "Oh, goodbye! Oh no!"
that was pretty much that. But I definitely say yay on it. If you're expecting a kid, it's a must watch.
I'm sure everybody who goes to a Lamaze class will be seeing this.
Yeah, good luck finding it. Oh, actually, you can find it. All 16, it's broken up into 16 parts on YouTube.
Oh, there you go.
I'm going to do it on my work tomorrow. Oh, I, too, have seen this movie. Watch it next week.
Yeah. And then finally, I was hoping that we could discuss the mid-season finale of The Walking Dead, season 3.
Yes. So, okay. So this is the end of our yay or nay segment. So we're going to spoil the shit out of this entire series, at least. So if you don't want to be spoiled, just jump ahead to our next segment, which will be Trailer Hitches. So spoilers for The Walking Dead starting now. Hermano, what did you think?
Of the series as a whole, or just the mid-season?
The mid-season finale.
I liked it. I feel like they showed their hand a little bit as far as the cliffhanger, because I don't know if you stick around for the previews usually after the show.
They give away, yeah.
The only time I ever do that is at the mid-season finale, because I never do that.
Did you notice something? Someone was in that preview for the second half of the season.
Someone was in there?
Yeah, you didn't notice it?
No.
Well, one of the characters they leave you. We're in spoilers, right?
Yeah.
Well, basically, the episode ends with Daryl being reunited with his brother Merle.
Yes. Ah, but reunited in a pit to fight to the death.
Yes. The governor is pissed because Merle lied about Michonne having killed Michonne.
Right.
Or Michonne. I forgot.
Michonne.
Michonne, all right. You know, obviously he's pissed because he's lost an eye. And,
a child. A dead child.
And a child.
Again.
And, you know, Merle, he throws Merle into the pit. Yeah. Well, it's not really a pit. It's just like he surrounds
this arena.
Like, it's like this little arena where, you know, apparently he's going to have them maybe potentially fight. And I'm thinking, all right, well, I'm assuming one person's going to come out alive. And then in the previews for the end, for the next half of the season, they show somebody.
I was looking for
it was really brief, and I think Wally probably saw. I don't know. Should we talk about it?
Yeah.
You see Daryl.
You see Daryl running. In a preview for the next...
I did not notice him.
So I'm like, all right, either he kills his brother, or Merle's in the next season, but maybe they're just hiding that and maybe just throwing you off a little bit. Like, I think maybe it's intentional to show Daryl, so you get...
There's another scene in that at the beginning of that thing where you see the governor looking, like, kind of walking slowly downhill, looking out, like, toward the horizon.
Yeah.
With a couple people behind him, and there's smoke everywhere. So, I'm pretty certain Daryl and takes off with Merle. Like, they create some sort of diversion.
Well, what about... that could be another rescue mission from Rick, you know?
No, Rick's already long gone by this time.
You think so?
Yeah, because they're getting Glenn and his girlfriend back to the prison.
Okay, then, overall, the whole season, what have you thought so far?
I definitely liked it. I don't know... It's not really just a memory, but I've heard a lot of backlash against last season.
Yeah, me too.
Especially the first half of it, and I don't know that it's completely warranted. Like, yeah, I hadn't. I know it was a lot of setup, and maybe people didn't like that because it did seem for a long time that the survivors were pretty much just hanging around Herschel's farm.
Well, there wasn't a lot of forward motion physically.
You know? Because they're stuck in that one location, and there wasn't a ton of action. Every once in a while, they'd kill a zombie, or was the zombie in the well, or you know, stuff like that. But I thought the reveal. At midway of night, I think that's still my favorite part of the entire series.
Yeah,
because it completely surprised me. And usually, I'm a person that's always looking for what's their angle, what are they trying to hide, what are they gonna try to surprise me with. And I didn't even think of it. Yeah. I just totally. And I thought of it later, and I was like, man, I should have thought of that. Like, why did that never even just enter my mind? Mm-hmm. And I was blown away. And like, as far as this season, I think they must have heard a lot of the complaints, and they try to definitely up the action.
Oh, they up the action already.
Because, like, every episode, there's, like, zombies getting access to the face, like, Michonne's decapitating zombies. Michonne, sorry. And that's fine, too. I don't know. Like, I like it. I'm definitely not complaining. I just feel like maybe they're overdoing it a little bit.
I don't know. I still think they're really balancing it well with what is truly the threat in this world is other people. You know, that's really the threat. And trust is such a commodity, you know? And the ability to trust someone, you can see that the only people that the group in the prison trust are themselves, you know? Yeah. They've even taught Carl not to trust anybody, but still at least be... And be cautious, because you can see at the end when Tyrese and his crew come from the woods, you know, and find themselves in the prison, he brings them in, you know, to a location in the prison, but he locks them in so that they're still separated until Rick and everybody else comes back.
Yeah, yeah.
That Tyrese group cracked me up when I saw them.
Yeah?
I'm sitting there going, my first thing I thought of was Shaun of the Dead. Like, oh, look, it's like their counterparts. There's another T-Dog. There's another Rick. There's another Lori. Like, and then the guy kind of looks a lot like Glenn.
Now, I'm not familiar enough of the graphic novels. I had been given up the series of novels up until... they get to the prison, or they see the prison over the hill.
Yep.
I have not read past that. You're much more familiar with them.
Yes.
So, and I understand, and as I've even seen, you know, they diverge a lot compared to the novels and what you see in the series.
That's on purpose.
Sure, sure it is. And I'm sure it's, you know, it's for the better as well. Or else you'd have a new location every single episode, pretty much. Anyways, what are your thoughts on how they...
Well, I know that Robert Kirkman, there's things that happen in the book that Robert Kirkman has gone on record saying, I kind of wish I didn't do that.
Right.
And Walking Dead's away from the TV series, away from to kind of extrapolate. Well, if I didn't do it this way, and if I went this way, you know, how does this all work out? When it comes to the books, when they get to the prison, a whole lot more ill shit happens. Uh-huh. Like, stuff that I'm sitting there going, oh, the introduction of the governor, I don't know how they're going to show this on TV.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give anything away, because I know what, you know, there's potential things that could happen, depending on which way they go with it.
Yeah.
But it loosely follows the book.
Sure.
You know, they're at the prison. I was like, okay. And there's other things that happen later that I'm curious how they're gonna do, you know, pull those things off. But we'll see how many you know seasons it gets renewed for.
So one thing I have a theory about is, you know, you've seen, especially in this season, they have no fear of killing anybody. Oh, well, first off, let me say, talking about killing people off, it's getting kind of ridiculous about the revolving door of black people in this show now.
Well, they've got two of them.
Okay.
There's Tyrese and his girlfriend.
Okay, fine, but male black character, black male characters. You know, you're right. There's been an introduction of his girlfriend as well, but it's getting kind of ridiculous. One dies, another one pops in. You know, it's kind of silly.
Yeah, it's like they're trying to fill a quota or something. Like they're just like
I wonder if the producers are like keenly aware of this. And we're just going to run with this joke until someone complains.
That is not something to joke about. Not well, these days.
Unless they're doing that whole jokey, like, I don't know what you would call it, but that whole thing, like, I think it's been, especially in 90s movies, it was like, you know, the black guy always dies
like
first.
A spoof?
Yeah, like, they're just playing up
There's a great meme with T-Dog on it. It's like, congratulations to T-Dog for doing what no black man has done. Make it to season 3.
One of my theories, though, is that by next season, I think Rick is going to be killed off. And Tyrese is going to take over. This is my first thought when I saw Tyrese his very first scene. I was like, this is a dominant kick-ass character, I just have this feeling that he would make a good leader, you know. And I have a feeling that they're going to kill off Rick.
What if they kill off Daryl?
That would be tough. That would be really tough.
Up until this point, I think the hardest death I've taken is probably Dale in end of season 2. Even more than Shane. Like, I felt Dale's death.
Yeah, Shane was on the Dino World spiral.
Yeah, because he became a very unlikable. Yeah. Where, he, you know, in the beginning he was kind of likable, even though he was kind of doing, you know, using douchey tactics.
Kind of doing
Rick Flair. He had nothing left anyways, you know.
No, yeah, he was... But as far as Dale and that, the way he dies and how he's trying to keep the group together and trying to do things the right way.
Yeah.
And then he's killed off and you're just like, man, that sucks because He just tried to do it the right way and not be like Shane and not be even like where Rick is somewhere in between Dale and Shane, where Rick is like, you know, the hero character, but he has no problem like killing someone if you think it's for the betterment of the group.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of, you know, in between. And Dale was just like, no, you should never do that. And even T-Dog was mm-hmm. kind of like that towards the end. They only gave him like one episode to really be like, you know what, let's trust these guys.
They only fleshed him out in the third season.
Yeah, and then he, as soon as, I honestly knew it, as soon as he had more lines in this episode than he did in like pretty much any other episode, he was just kind of always in the background. And as soon as that happened, I was like, they're going to kill him.
Yeah.
Because they're just trying to make it seem a little more heart-wrenching or poetic, you know, like a poetic end to his character. But I don't know, like... I love the show, man. I love where it's going. I have never read the graphic novels, but I have had some stuff explained to me as far as what the differences are between the novel, the graphic novel, and the show. And in some ways, I think the show, I think I like some aspects of what the show is doing, but in other ways, I like, I think how the darker ways that they do things in the graphic novel. And I understand why they maybe can't do some of these things on TV because. Not to say that they're holding anything back on TV, because they're definitely not. Because I mean, they do show some pretty gnarly stuff for like considering, even though it's like at 9 o'clock or whatever.
Robert Kirkman has even stated on The Talking Dead that they keep pushing the boundaries of the censors, wondering if they're ever going to, you know, cut anything, have them be forced to cut anything. He said, nope, nothing yet. So we'll keep going.
I just think a lot of the stuff they do in the graphic novel would maybe be a little harder for audiences to handle.
Yeah. But overall, it's a yay show.
Watch it. Something to do on Sunday nights. Well, not right now, but
yeah, unfortunately,
come February.
Unfortunately, another 2 months to
February 10th. I heard. Yeah.
All right, that does it for yay or nay. Let's move on into trailer hitches. This is the part of the show that gives us an opportunity to mention a movie trailer that either gets us on board for an upcoming movie or makes us want to bitch. Walter?
I'm going to hitch my trailer to Dark Skies. Yeah.
Why?
Because it looks like another shit movie. I'm only kidding. This is actually this movie. this movie looks... I sat there. Tim and I went to go see Killing Them Softly. That was one of the trailers we were treated with. And I put that in quotation marks.
I actually saw this as well.
And Tim will attest, my face went into my hand immediately. I just started slowly shaking my head going, what the fuck
All right.
has happened to horror movies? It's like, oh, when they take you, you have no choice. I'm like, at one point, he's pointing a gun at some light. You can't shoot a gun at light. Nothing happens.
All right. When I saw this trailer, it was the last trailer that played, and I honestly thought it was one of those fake trailers they played to tell you to shut your cell phone off. I was like, there's no way this is a real movie, except that thing was in it, Felicity or whatever.
Kerry Russell? And so was J. Jonah Jameson. I can't
think of it. J.K. Simmons.
J.K. Simmons.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, is this a fake trailer? Are they getting, like, better talent to sell it a little more? And I couldn't believe it was a real movie. I'm like, really?
Yeah, this movie looks like utter shit. Completely not hitching my trailer. This is a total bitch. But I could go on and on about just the stupid, tropey things that they do where, like, you know, missing time, and then, you know, for whatever reason, she starts banging her head against the window, just not stopping.
So the director, Scott Charles Stewart, great three names, also did Priest and Legion.
All right.
Well, I saw Legion. Legion was terrible.
Priest was fun for what it was. Wasn't anything great. It was just fun. But this movie looks utterly stupid. And no, don't even... Save your money, people. Take this one to heart. Save your money. Go see something more worthwhile.
Hermano?
All right. I'm going to pre-hitch to this one. It's a movie called The ABCs of Death.
I saw this trailer with you as well.
Yeah. I've been actually looking forward to this ever since I heard about it. Basically, the premise is... Much like VHS, except on a larger scale.
Yeah,
it's an anthology film.
A 26-chapter anthology.
Yes.
26 in 123 minutes.
Yep. And, well, they're all short films. I think they're all about 5 minutes. And the premise is all these different... There's 26 different directors, each of them assigned a letter of the alphabet. And then once they're given a letter, they come up with a word that starts with that letter, and then they make a horror movie about it. I think the premise is awesome because you get all these different directors like Ty West. I think a lot of the guys that actually worked on VHS are involved in this, the making of this. And I just looking at the trailer and you see just the varying amount and different looks to all these different horror movies.
It looks like every genre of horror is in there. Everything. I'm sorry.
No. It's fine. You got, like, a horror movie that looks like it's completely made out of claymation.
Mm-hmm.
You got one that looks like it's something similar to, like, all the horrific parts of American Psycho. You got one that looks like a guy that's fighting a dog in, like, some kind of Fight Club-esque horror movie.
I gotta see this trailer.
J-horror.
Yeah, there's, like, a J-horror one with a guy with a samurai sword. Like, it looks completely off the wall.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre-like.
Yes. One with a woman that's wearing, like, a coyote mask or something, and she's dressed up like a housewife from the 50s. Like, it's all over the place, Wally. Yeah.
I gotta see this.
You would completely cream over this trailer alone.
It sounds like something I would love to see.
I absolutely hitch, because I loved VHS. I can't wait for you guys to see it, because I think it's a great film. And this one just looks like it's going to be just as good, so definitely check it out.
Tim?
I will talk about Warm Bodies.
Oh, I can't wait for this one, too!
Note sarcasm, because, dear God, this looks bad.
Oh, no!
So, after a zombie becomes involved with his girlfriend on one of the... I'm sorry. Let me start over. After a zombie becomes involved with the girlfriend of one of his victims, their romance sets in motion a sequence of events that might transform the entire lifeless world. So, obviously, this zombie sees this woman. He is so enamored with her, and you all of a sudden see his heart beat.
His heart begin to beat again.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, there looks like it's mixing genres. Like, it's a horror comedy.
Yeah.
You know, but the way it's filmed looks so muddy. It looks like it has bad special effects. It's just...
I think potentially on purpose, though, don't you think?
I don't know. No.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I was originally going to talk about this trailer, but Tim had already, you know, selected it. So that's, I was like, right. Fine, you can talk about that. I'll talk about... the other one.
You know what it is? It just, like, it's PG-13, so it's a horror comedy for teenagers. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look like... It looks like that. It looks like this bad romantic comedy, just with the zombie aspect to it.
You didn't get like a kind of like maybe a Zombieland vibe from it?
No,
not at all.
No? No, not with the way, especially with the way they made the main character specifically look like Edward Cullen.
Well, he's the actor that the main zombie actor.
Nicholas Holt?
He played Beast in X-Men, right?
I think you're right.
Yeah, so, I mean, not that's anything to, like, just grasp onto and say automatically good movie, but John Malkovich is in it. I don't know, when I was watching it at first, I was like, I was kind of on the fence, and then I was definitely, for me personally, I got a Zombieland vibe, sort of. Like, where it was going for that type of, like, quirky, you know, humor, you know? I don't think it looks completely terrible. It sounds like you're gonna bitch about it.
I am bitching about it. Right.
I don't know. I'll give it a chance, I think. What is it, like a February release or something like
that? Something like that. I already closed the window. I'm not gonna open it back up.
You know, this looks like certainly a remake of another movie I've seen a while back called Boy Eats Girl.
Look at that shiny 4.9 it's getting on.
So it's an Irish zombie movie. Boy declares his love for his girlfriend, only to die in the same night. He is brought back to life by his mother as a flesh-craving zombie who sires more teen undead while trying to control his appetite for his beloved.
Oh boy!
The movie that Tim is referring to looks like a piss poor attempt at remaking that movie.
An already crappy movie. Okay. All right. Let's move on into our discussion of Killing Them Softly. The plot. Jackie Kogan is an enforcer hired to restore order after three dumb guys rob a mob-protected card game, causing the local criminal economy to a collapse. The writer and director, Andrew Dominik. The actors, Brad Pitt, Ray Liotta, James Gandolfini, Richard Jenkins, Scoot McNairy, and Ben Mendelsohn. Hermano.
Yes.
You have seen and owned the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, which Dominik wrote and directed as well.
Yes.
Now, I understand that you enjoy that movie. You like that movie a lot.
I do like it. It's one of those movies. It's very long. I think it's like over 2.5 hours long. It's not a movie that lends itself to multiple rewatches for me personally. There are a lot of it's kind of like a slog. The movie, like, it just takes a long time to kind of do anything, and there are a lot of long, drawn-out scenes, which I definitely usually don't like, especially in a really long movie. But I will definitely give them points on the movie. Looks gorgeous. Where they shot and just the costume design, and the movie definitely looks of its time, and I think they even used, like, older lenses on the cameras to capture that look of, like, a kind of a, like, a Western, type movie, and I definitely think it's a good movie. I'd definitely probably watch it again at some point, but probably not for a few years. You know what I mean? It's just not a movie that I can watch like every year or anything like that.
Okay, then do you think that this is another movie of his that you'd be willing to revisit or even purchase in the future?
Okay. I'm gonna kind of dissect this movie a little bit on things I liked and things I didn't like. As far as things I liked, just basically there were two scenes that I liked. One is an assassination scene that takes place in a car stopped at a stoplight. And another was the heist itself. I thought that was a really tense scene up to a point. And then the way it ends kind of made me kind of just throw my hands up and be like, hmm? But as far as things I didn't like, I think this movie is extremely dull. It's boring. It's really, really boring. Like, there are times where the way this movie opens, basically, is you're introduced to the Frankie character played by Scoot McNairy, and he's just walking around and he meets up with a guy that owns a dry cleaning service. And they're pretty much planning this to hold up this card game. And I'm like, that scene went on forever. I was like, man, you could have explained what they're doing in like a minute. Like, there was nothing grand about what they were doing. And he introduces this other guy that he wants to pull the heist off with. And once it got to the heist, I'm like, all right, please let the movie stay at this level. Like, the heist I thought was pretty damn good. Like, it was tense. You felt like there was a lot of danger at any moment because, I mean, there's like 20 guys in there. There's like two tables filled with all these gangsters playing cards. And it's two guys robbing it. And I'm like, you see guys maybe, start to reach for their guns and then pull back when someone notices it. One of the guys holding them up notices, and they have like this ridiculous looking sawed off shotgun, which they've sawed off very too short.
Sawed off shotgun.
I mean, you could actually see the shells sticking out of the barrels, which is crazy because if they were to fire it, it would just totally demolish everything in the room. But once it leaves that, and then you're introduced to the Brad Pitt character, he comes in about maybe half an hour into the film, 20 minutes, half an hour, something like that. I was like, oh God, man. Like, every scene after that was like, every scene with James Gandolfini was totally unnecessary. His character adds absolutely nothing to this movie. If you left him out, the movie would have been exactly the same, nothing different. He's not important to the plot. He's just there to show maybe a level of what Brad Pitt may become when he's older. That's pretty much it. It was kind of like a window into Brad Pitt's future, potentially. And the way this movie ends, it just kind of... There are scenes in this movie that almost don't belong in this movie. Like, especially the scene I was referring to with the assassination of one of the characters. It looks gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's super stylized. But the rest of the movie is, like, grungy looking. And they go out of the way to show, like, trashy looking streets and neighborhoods. And then they'll show this scene, which looks amazing. Like, it looks like it belongs in a movie like Drive or something, like where it's super stylized, like, you know, just everything about it exudes cool. And it just didn't belong in this movie. And then I'm like, all right, well, you just did that just because it's cool, I guess. Because otherwise there's nothing... I mean, he could have just did that in a way that fit the movie better. Just an assassin, you know what I mean? But ultimately, when the movie was done, I was like... Wow, this movie... I usually am crazy about movies like this. I love, like, mob genre movies, and this one just did not do it for me. I just walked out thinking, man, that was, like, a really, really boring.
Walter?
Yeah, there should be a little subtext to this movie called Killing Them Softly. Look at all these cool characters you remember liking, and we're not going to do anything with them. James Gandolfini, Vincent Curatola, who our viewers might know as, you know, Tony Soprano, and Johnny Sack from... The Sopranos. This movie, I'm gonna side with Hermano on this one. This movie was dull, very dull. I was hoping for like some sort of like spice in the movie, something to, you know, kind of perk him and go, oh, now I'm paying attention. But no, the story basically looks like, all right, our car getting up robbed. Well, we need to get. We'll talk to this guy who knows guys that he can do the job. Do you want to do the job? Well, I'll do one of the three guys. I'm gonna bring in somebody to take care of the others. Oh fuck! I gotta do it all myself then, I guess, because you're utterly fucking useless. So, you know, biggity baggity boom, takes care of it, and then the cuts with all the political stuff going on for the 2008 election between McCain and Obama. I don't understand. It's supposed to be taking place somewhere near Boston, and it doesn't look anything like the Boston that I know. And I've been around much of the Boston area, so they go, you know what? I didn't even think parts of Roxbury look like this. Like, I have no idea where this is. This doesn't look at all like what I'm used to being. You know,
if I had to guess, I'd say it was like South Boston, maybe.
Even Southie doesn't look like that. Like, yeah. It's not that disgusting and trashy and all, you know, all that.
I think you can find areas that are like that.
The tunnel full of just with nothing but just trash papers spinning around. I've never seen it. Scoot Maneri's friend, though. I sat there and just every time he would appear on the screen, I can't think of the actor's name.
Ben Mendelsohn.
Every time Ben Mendelsohn appeared on the screen, I was his character. Was probably the one that I sat there and went, these are what people in Bedford look like on a regular basis. Like, he just always looks dirty, and he's sweating constantly. Sweating
all the profusely, time.
And he's, like, always on a nod. And
it's hot.
And from the average people that I see, you know, near the bus station or whatever, you know, in New Bedford themselves, Bedford's Bedford has a reputation of being we have a lot of heroin users in the city. And I see a lot of these guys on the street just kind of shambling around when I'm on my way to work in the morning, when I'm on my way home at night. And I was like, that's disgusting, because I know exactly what that person looks like, you know? And, I thought Brad Pitt's character is actually really cool, and I wish they would have done kind of more with him other than have him sit in the car and talking most of the movie, and then going off and doing something and then coming back and talking in the car again. Like, I was really interested in, like, the Jackie Kogan character. I was like, this guy's actually kind of badass. But this movie's not going anywhere. He's kind of just running around in circles, chasing his own tail. And I think overall, I think the whole point of the movie was lost on me. Because I like gangster movies, and like I'm a big fan of Drive, which is, you know, a crime movie that grips me from the beginning to end, no matter how many times I see it. I'm like, I'm in. And this one is like, I could take it or leave it.
Well, that's interesting. I'm really surprised that I'm going to be the lone wolf on this episode, because I figured, Hermana, you would have appreciated this more. I had a feeling Wally would have been like what you said, you know, Wally. Hermano, I figured you would have liked this more. I was hooked from the moment the film started rolling. It has one of the most unusual openings I've seen this year, and I appreciated it. I loved the opening.
I thought our theater was broken, actually, at the
beginning. I know, because it was is these really strange sounds intercut with the presidential elections, you know, cuts of the presidential election in 2008. And I immediately cocked my head to the side. I was like, what's going on here? And I was glued from that point on, you know. And one of my first thoughts in the opening scenes was, geez, this is one depressing town. I would never want to live there. And then later on, you learn it's around Boston. I'm like, oh, shit. I think the scenes between Pitt and Gandolfini are my favorite. You know, I love their dialogue and how it crackles. And it really gets to the meat of the message of this film, because it tells you right from the beginning that this is a commentary on how this level of mobsters, if you will, criminals, are actually affected by the downturn in the economy in 08, and how it didn't just affect the people that the political figures, and McCain and Obama, if you will, were talking on, discussing on, you know, on our new television set. It wasn't just about the middle class and the upper class and some of the lower class. It's actually the economy has hurt the mob, the gangsters as well. And this is showing you that. And I loved it. I thought it was amazing. I think it's a gorgeous movie. I think it's filmed great. You know, you, Hermano, had complained about the one scene, the hit on a character at a stoplight. That scene, you know, was gorgeous. But then all the other scenes you thought were grungy. I thought that was the point, because this could also have been taken, you know, looked like he was trying to make a 70s a film as well. Because look at all the cars that they're driving. Except for the car Richard Jenkins is driving, every other car is from the 70s. You know,
well, the book that this was based on was written in the '70s, in 1974.
There you go. So he's obviously trying to harken back to that time of filmmaking as well. You know, and I thought it totally worked for the areas that they were filming in, the grungy, dirty parts of outer Boston. You know, and there's a scene where Ray Liotta gets beat up in the rain, which is brutal. You know, and it's also heightened because of the sound design in that, but. Did you notice how it was filmed? Like
extremely sharp.
Yeah, it looked like it was filmed on super high speed camera and then played at normal speed. You know, because it's like you could see every single raindrop, and every single drop of blood. It was awesome.
They kept ramping and you know, slowing up and speeding up the rain, because the rain wasn't falling at a natural pace. It was just kind of like slowly falling, but the punches were coming a little faster. So they might have had the extras throw faster and then slowed it down or something to make it just look.
Did you
off.
Notice differences in speed?
I didn't notice any difference. I mean, some of the punches looks like it was like, you know, when he's slowing, it's like, guys, you know, cut it out, what the fuck? And then, you know, like hit, and then jump. You know, I saw the camera jumping a lot. Not so much speed, where like you'd see like Ray get hit and the guy's like, you know, would take a step backwards.
You know, and once again, the themes of this movie, you know, when Brad Pitt explains how he likes to kill people, and he says, I like to kill them softly, like to keep my distance, you know, I don't like to make a lot of commotion, I guess, is what he's trying to say.
This is like a touchy-feely, because people beg for their lives, they call for their mothers, they try to bargain, and he knows that he has a job to do, and he doesn't want to be swayed by any of that.
You know what that scene reminded me of? Up in the Air. Have you seen Up in the Air?
Yes.
You've seen it. That reminded me of Up in the Air, and that's perfectly, you know, consistent with the theme of this movie, because in that movie and Up in the Air, they want to fire their those employees softly, if you will. They want to fire them quietly, keep their distance, you know, do it over the internet. And these people, they start breaking down. They start calling for their mothers. They start, you know, in essence, asking for God and why are you doing this to me and all that kind of stuff. And it gets messy. So that's why they like to do it softly. It's a perfect. I would love to do this, do a double feature of this movie and Up in the Air. Perfect juxtaposition, I think. You know, the parallels between corporate stability and the criminal world, I loved it. I thought this movie was great.
I totally got what he was going for. I don't think it was a good idea because they hammer it home, like, hard. Like, how many times he pretty much scored the entire film with speeches from 2008.
That was great. Because it was, you know why I loved it so much? You know why? Even though it's telegraphed, it's from the very beginning.
But to do it over and over, and it's like any other movie just kept trying to hammer, like people call Darren Aronofsky, he's never subtle. And people bitch at him for that. Like, if people aren't bitching this guy for constantly, over and over, playing an excerpt from a speech that talks about the recession or people need to, you know, we need to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and we're all in this together and, like, stuff like that. And I'm like, all right, I get what you're doing, dude. You could have done that once and I would have get the parallel you're trying to make. The recession hits everyone. Mobsters are not exempt from feeling the effects of the recession. I'm like, all right, that's fine. You got your point across. But he did it over and over and over. Like, James Gandolfini is introduced to that. Brad Pitt goes into a bar, it's playing on a TV. Like, everything. Like, and then I'm like, dude, this is overboard. Like, you're going way overboard. But I don't want to totally trash this movie because I was on the fence. Like, after I thought about it a little more, I'm like, you know what? I kind of did like some of the stuff. Like, but I felt like a lot of the scenes that I liked just felt out of this movie. Like Mia brought up a good point of one of the scenes later on in the movie where Brad Pitt's in the car with somebody and he gets out because he's about to go do a hit. And it's obvious that the camera is mounted on the door.
I love that scene.
That was an awesome scene.
I love the fact that the camera's mounted on the actual door.
Yeah, he opens the door, the camera swings out, Brad Pitt gets out of the car, and then he closes the door and they didn't try to stabilize it or anything. The camera shakes and the character that's in the car is shaking by what's about to happen. So it's like, that's a great effective use of the camera.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's ballsy because it takes you out of the movie because it's so obvious.
Yeah.
It's a camera mounted on a door.
I did say genius. Remember I said that at that moment? Yeah, but you're right. I understand how it did take
you. It's like a double-edged sword. Like, yes, it's a creative shot and you got an emotion across with just shaking a camera and it parallels what the character you're pointing the camera at is feeling. But at the same time, it takes you out of the movie. It's like, if it's like the equivalent of someone looking at the camera and talking to it.
Well, you could say the same thing about the hit in at the stoplight, you know, and how stylized that is and how super slow. I don't think I've ever seen a movie that has gone that super slow mo, you know, and showing all the details.
Even that scene, though, you don't think it was a little over the top by how gratuitously violent it was? Like, not only does this guy get hit by like five bullets, but
two cars
just come. One car hits him first, another car hits him first, his head goes through the windshield. I'm like, man, like, I don't know. See, this is one of those things where I wish sometimes directors would kind of try to tell you what they were trying to convey in a scene. If he was trying to convey, hey, I want to show you a stylized, like, almost glamorizing a kill and do it in a way over the top way, then he succeeded completely.
Yeah.
But if he was just going for something looking, you know, somewhat cool, then I think he went a little overboard.
Yeah, honestly, you're right. It looks amazing, although I don't know what the point of that scene is.
And you don't feel like it sticks out completely out of this movie? Like, the rest of the movie, I thought, looked really dirty. Like when he goes into the dry cleaner, the place just looks like a slummy place I'd never want to watch.
No, because the scene where Ray Liotta gets beat up in the rain, that looks just as glossy. That looks just great.
It looks
great.
Sharp, and like they shot it on a, like, I don't know, like an expensive slow motion camera. But even where the card game is held, they have to go through this dirty looking skinny back alley behind some building in where there's like little drawn curtains for a doorway, and it just looks like just everything else in the movie looks really dirty, and then they'll really glossy up the kills. You know what I mean? Like, it just seemed like a little out of
place.
Maybe
there is a theme there that he's trying to convey, and I just haven't pinpointed it yet. Maybe he's trying to say something about the glossiness of and excess of the death in the mob world,
yeah.
versus the grunginess and the grittiness and the realism of other, you know, the other scenes. You know, maybe if we read up on somebody else reviewing this movie, you know, they'll be able to pinpoint that a little bit
more. But we do have someone else who has reviewed this movie.
We'll get to that. After our grades. Was there anything else you guys wanted to mention?
Just quickly, Brad Pitt's character and the way he's introduced, and I feel like there are really no likable characters in this movie. That's another problem I have with the movie, because there's no one for me to, like, just grab onto and be like, I'm following that dude, and he's like the hero, or there's no hero character. Everyone's just kind of a dumbass.
Everybody's an anti-hero. Yeah.
And I love, the one thing I did like about Brad Pitt's character is how he's kind of in a position where he's caught in between a bunch of people he works for, the mob, who he considers like just kind of idiots, how no one person can make a decision. It's everything's like a community decision. Like all like these Congress. Guys got to get together to make one decision. And then, on the other hand, he's dealing with the most degenerative, like, dumb people, like criminals, that he's like, man, these people are stupid. Like, I mean, he finds out who he's got to kill. It pretty much lands in his lap. Like, he doesn't do any kind of investigative work. You don't get to see, like, him, like, just working it out and finding his man and stuff like that. Like, it just kind of falls into his lap.
Yeah, because somebody talked to somebody who knew Dylan, who told him what was going on. And he's like, and these stupid kids can't even keep their mouth shut about anything anymore.
So you never really get to know him that well. It just kind of falls into his lap.
I think that's more realistic in that world. You know, I think information like that is carried on a little more easily and would arrive at him like
that. And he explains that in the movie. He's like, I can't believe these guys. No one knows how to keep their fucking mouth shut. Like, I can't believe it's this easy. Like, you know what I mean? And that's fine, I guess, as like a commentary on like criminals are stupid, inherently stupid.
It leads me to be that Brad Pitt's of the old school hitter. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you don't talk about anything. If you do something, keep your mouth shut. You know what I mean? Even Ray Liotta's character is guilty of breaking that when he's with his friends and he talks about like, aha!
Yeah. And, you know, I like that as far as a commentary on like, you know, these mob guys, like, they're stupid. They're not exempt from, you know, feeling hits of recession. I mean, in the movie, they're like considered like low level mobsters, because when a card game of like 100,000 can cripple your economy, your mob economy, that doesn't seem like a substantial amount for a mob outfit. You know what I mean?
But it looked like the mob area, you know, the area that they're targeting would be home to low level mobsters.
Yeah.
You know? Like anymore?
I think I figured out, while listening to you guys talk, I think I figured out one of the reasons why I don't like this movie. There's no conflict. There's no stakes. It's just one guy, you're following one guy basically cleaning up a mess. Who wants to watch a movie about a janitor? Because that's essentially what he's doing. He's basically cleaning up so that everything can get back to normal again. But he's not, no one's opposing him. You know, he's basically just like, all right, well, I found this guy, I just got to get him. Now I found this guy, I'm going to go get him. I found this guy, I'm going to go get him. All right, we're done.
Yeah, but that's not really the point of the movie. I think it's a commentary.
It's an
economic commentary.
There still needs to be some sort of conflict, that it had to have some sort of stakes. There's no stakes in this movie. It's just something just happens. It just happens. That's the best way to put it. There's nothing like, Brad Pitt's not racing against the clock. He's not being chased by other mobsters. He's basically like, all right, well, I guess I got to do this. I wanted James Gandolfini to help me, but he's utterly useless, so I guess I have to do it all myself. Didn't really want to, but all right, well, let's follow this guy around.
I'm definitely in agreement with Wally. I mean, the story is fairly simple. Guys rob a card game. Brad Pitt has to figure out who does it. He does what he does at the end of the movie. Like, it's a very simple story. I mean, they try to, like, overlay this, like, you know, this economic crisis angle to the movie, but I don't know that adds a lot of weight to what's going on in the movie. Like, it's just like, oh, mobsters have it rough, boo-hoo. Like, I don't know that it makes the movie any more weighty, you know, adding all these overlays of, like, these speeches. And I think he was trying to do something clever, but it just didn't fully mesh for me. I don't know.
I guess that's it. You want to get into spoilers?
Yeah, there's not really much to choose.
There's only one thing I want to mention.
Spoilers. We spoil this movie, but we're going to spoilers.
Okay, spoilers. One thing I want to do, that I think the piece of dialogue that Brad Pitt says at the end of this movie perfectly summarizes the whole theme of the film. And it goes like this. My friend Thomas Jefferson is an American saint because he wrote the words, "All men are created equal." Words he clearly did not believe, since he allowed his own children to live in slavery. He's a rich wine snob who's sick of paying taxes to the Brits. So yeah, he writes some lovely words and aroused the rabble, and they went and died for those words while he sat back and drank his wine and fucked his slave girl. This guy wants to tell me we're living in a community? Don't make me laugh. I'm living in America. In America, you're on your own. America's not a country. It's just business. Now fucking pay me. Fade to black. And that, I love the ending. And you Hermano, had said, you're like, yeah, that's it? At that point?
I know what they were trying to do, where, like, even before that, like, Richard Jenkins, that's his name, right?
Yes.
The actor. He's trying to shortchange Brad Pitt a little bit and say, like, well, you only killed these three guys, you didn't actually get the fourth one, because the fourth one ends up getting arrested for his drug use or whatever. And he's trying to pay Brad Pitt a wage that was less than what James Gandolfini's character would have gotten. He tried to pay him $10,000 per kill. And that's what causes Brad Pitt to go into his little speech and stuff like that. I just felt like I thought something else was going to happen. Like, when it ended there, I'm like, all right, you got your message across yet again that the mob is just trying to shortchange. They're going through hard times. They can't afford to pay you the rate you would normally get. We're in hard times, Richard Jenkins' character says. And I'm thinking, like, something's going to happen. Like, maybe Richard Jenkins had backup, you know, like, in case Brad Pitt, you know, flew off the handle or something and got pissed. And it just, he goes on the speech, says, "Fuck you, pay me," ends. And I'm like, and then it goes into that fucking song where it's like, "The best things in life are free. You know, I need money." And I'm like, oh, it's so cliche. And even the way Brad Pitt enters this movie, he enters to a Johnny Cash song.
Yep.
And
then I later love on, that entry. It's a perfect song
to enter. It's very cliche. Like, to enter, he enters to a Johnny Cash song. It's like, it's what I couldn't even, if I had to guess, if someone asked me, hey, you're about to see this movie, Brad Pitt's character enters to a song, I would have almost 99 of 100 times picked a Johnny Cash song. It's just the obvious choice.
Especially, like, when he's wearing all black through the entire movie.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, it just seemed like, and then that song at the end, I was just like, another, like, really obvious song. Like, I don't know what the director was trying to get across. Like, I feel like, I don't know if he was just trying to be like, this is the level of movies that are made these days. And he wanted to do something that wasn't well-liked or well-received. Maybe a commentary on the types of mob movies we've been getting lately. Like, nothing's The Godfather anymore. Nothing's like Casino or Goodfellas anymore. Like, this is the level of mobster we have nowadays. If that's his commentary, then he did a good job. But I have no idea to know what he was trying to get across. So I don't know. I'm basing it on my enjoyment of the movie, and ultimately I walked out of it and I was bored.
Yeah, without conflict, this movie, you know, lost me. I had no one to really follow, or, like, really anybody to root for. I think the scene I probably like Brad Pitt, there's two scenes with Brad Pitt that I really liked. The first, so when he's talking to the hooker that James Gandolfini has. Which is, "You want to zip me?" And he goes, "No." And she laughs at him, and she, like, stares at him. He just stares back at her. "I thought you were joking." He goes, "I'm not. Why don't you go ask a trick to go zip you up?" And she gets pissed.
Yeah.
There's that one. And then I really like the interaction between him and Scoot McNairy in the bar.
That was my favorite scene with him.
He basically reveals he knows who Scoot McNairy is, and he knows what he's done.
It's a great slow reveal.
By kind of telling him, like, a roundabout story. And he's like, I don't think I know you. And then, you know, Jackie just turns and goes, "Yeah, a few people do." You know what I mean? And basically, it basically just tells him, it's like, "You can help me find the guy I need, and tell me where he's going to be, and you might as well tell me where you're going to be tomorrow, because I'm coming to kill you next if you don't help me out." You know what I mean? And that was a really cool, like, back and forth between the two of them, because you can see it register on Scoot McNary's face, like, he knows he's fucked. No matter, you know, "I don't know what to do. Do I go with this guy and give up the guy who's paying me to, you know, who's paying me money? Do I give him up to this guy who I don't know, or do I risk this guy coming after me next?" And those are probably my two favorite scenes. But without any actual conflict, I just lost me. I just kind of just let the movie kind of happen around me. What's his name again? McDermott?
Ben Mendelsohn?
Ben Mendelsohn, that's his name. His character, I was hoping his character was going to get off quick, because, oh, yeah, like, he just annoyed the shit out of me. Because if you were in any sort of organized crime, you would probably, he'd be the first one to go. Because you cannot trust addicts.
But ultimately, he just gets taken by the cops, right?
Yeah, he gets arrested by the cops. Mm-hmm. And just, I don't know, just, I was happy to see him go, but I wanted to see him offed. And there's, other than that, without the conflict, then it didn't have anything for me.
The scene where Brad Pitt shoots, what's his face, Scoot McNairy's
Vincent Caratola.
Okay, yeah, the owner of the cleaners.
Yep.
He gets out of the car and aims his gun at him, and it's a shotgun, and he's like 50, 75 feet away, and I'm like, is he really gonna kill him with a shotgun from that far away? I was like, you think you need a rifle or something, or at least a handgun.
If you're using solid slug, you can get from that distance.
Yeah, but I mean, he still had to go up to him.
It just kind of goes against the idea of killing them softly. Like he's not
killing them loudly.
He's not using a silencer. He's near an apartment complex.
Well, when he says killing them softly, he means not getting involved with them, having them in a closed room.
I completely understand that he doesn't want all the gushy feelings and people begging for their lives. I get that, but I mean, he's not very careful. Like, he's just kind of like, he kills, we're in spoilers. Ray Liotta's character, he kills, and he's not a stoplight, that's fine. But that character I did not get, because he's shooting him with a shotgun from, like you said, like 50, 75 feet away, right near an apartment complex where this guy just dropped off a person. Mm-hmm. And the cops are called right away, because you hear sirens as soon as he starts to get back to the car. And I thought there was no surprise at all. Right after the bar scene, which Wally just said he liked, and I liked as well. I liked the way he convinces. I liked the idea of that scene that he calms Scoot McNairy down. He convinces them that he's not going to hurt him. That you have this chance to redeem yourself. A friend is trying to save you. But the thing I don't get on Scoot McNairy's side is the scene before that. He's in the dry cleaners talking to the boss and telling him that I'm worried because this dude talked and these guys are coming after us. We're on the list or something. And he's like, I got no friends. I got nowhere else to go. So why would he believe Brad Pitt and saying a friend is looking out for you? Come with me, do this hit with me, and you're free.
He's holding on to hope.
That's it's his only lifeline.
But I feel like there was no surprise. Like, it was very clear that Brad Pitt was going to kill him. Like, there was no surprise there. As soon as Brad Pitt got out of the car, I was like, he's absolutely going to kill this guy.
Yeah, because you have more information than Scoot McNairy has.
Yeah.
You know, he is, like you said, holding on to hope. So that this is his only thread to hold on to is that he's... Brad Pitt is going to hold on to his word.
All right. There was another hole in Brad Pitt's. He's very careful after he kills Scoot McNairy. What did he kill the guy with?
A handgun.
No. He killed Scoot McNairy with a handgun. Oh. What did he kill the other guy with?
Shotgun.
What does he walk out of the car with?
A handgun.
Where's the shotgun?
In the back seat.
In the back seat of the car. He left it there with his fingerprints on it. He never cleaned it.
He could have cleaned it on the ride back. It's possible. They didn't show it. Fine. You know, if it's a pothole, it's a pothole.
I felt like, I was like, does he have it in it? Because he had, like, did he have a trench coat on? No,
he had the leather jacket.
But I was like, he left the shotgun. I'm like, you left the shotgun. You're cleaning the door handles. You're clearing the steering wheel. But you left the shotgun in the back seat. And I'm like, what was the point of cleaning anything then if you didn't care about the shotgun? Unless he, like you said, he was cleaning it while they were driving. But he drives at one point.
Yeah, they switch places.
So he throws in the back seat. He's telling him to slow down because he's driving like a bat out of hell. And then he's like, I'll drive or whatever. And he drives. And then he shoots Scoot McNairy and leaves the gun in the car. I'm like, what? Whatever. I mean, I don't know. Like, I just... Ultimately, I was like, man, there were scenes in this movie that I really like. And then it's just not enough to save the movie.
It sounded like you wanted to like this
movie. I honestly, like, you know, I wanted to see Life of Pi. I don't know.
Well, originally, several weeks ago, you were really interested in seeing this
movie. I actually trailer hitched on this movie.
Yep.
Because I was like, I like the trailer. I like, you know, I think I'm going to like this movie. This looks like right up my alley. But then just watching the movie, I just thought all the scenes with Gandolfini, they were well acted. I agree with you. The dialogue is great between them. The interplay between him and Brad Pitt, but it's mostly Gandolfini. Brad Pitt is just kind of like sitting back and analyzing him. And
that's
just
being his character. Like,
this guy is not the killer, the assassin he used to be. He's just kind of a fat slob now, mm-hmm. and he's an alcoholic, and he just hires hookers and does drugs. And the way
he's a man who used to be on top of his game, but due to the economy, he has lost it.
And he has troubles of his own. Like, yeah. And I don't know. Like, I just felt like that added nothing to the movie. Like, I felt like maybe the movie didn't really need his character. It didn't do nothing for me personally. I don't know.
To me, it's not about the so-called plot of the movie. It's about the characters and how they deal with the circumstances that are around them. And it's character studies, really.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it for that. Is there anything else you want to mention, Wally?
That's all I got.
Anything else, Romano?
No, that's it.
Okay, so we got an email. What was his name? I feel bad. I want to mention his name now. Hang on it while I bring up the...
Wally, do you want to sing some songs to take up this
time? Here we go. Kyle Turner sent us an email regarding Killing Them Softly. And he sent us a lengthy email, but I condensed it as best as I could, I think. I do not believe I have ever watched a film that was so incredibly heavy-handed and yet had no idea what it was saying or how to say it. Killing Them Softly's cinematography felt like the bastard child of J.J. Abrams, Julian Schnabel, and Guy Ritchie. Granted, some of the scenes do look good, but there is by no means at all any kind of consistency to the images on the screen. Pitt's hitman, with his inconsistent moral views, he kills people and yet criticizes the United States, makes his character more pseudo-enigmatic rather than one of true depth. There is no real good study of any of the characters when this kind of film from this kind of director would definitely call for it. And he gives this movie a C-.
Interesting.
So he's more in line with you two, a little bit more harsh, I think.
I'm right there with him. I mean, I'm not going to be as harsh, but I'm not going to be that much more up on it.
So that transitions to grades. All Wally? Right.
I'm going to give it a straight C. I need conflict in my movies. I need a reason to care, and I don't get one. And I don't get any reason for that, any of that in this movie.
Yeah, I'm right with Wally. I was planning on giving it a C.
Wow. So I give it an A. So that would be a B minus average. All right. B minus average from the first time I watched this podcast. And thank you, Kyle Turner, for sending that email. Good insight. Okay, that does it for this episode of the First Time Watchers podcast. You can find us on Facebook by searching First Time Watchers. We post movie news and updates that we think you would be interested in. And you can email us at firsttimewatchers@gmail.com.
You can also follow us on Twitter at 1sttimewatchers@twitter.com.
Or follow us on our Tumblr page at firsttimewatchers.tumblr.com.
And please download our episodes on iTunes and feel free to leave a review. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. We want feedback. We love feedback. We want to know what you guys think of our show. If you have any suggestions for movies for us to watch, send a tweet, an email, or post on our Facebook page. And stay tuned for our next episode. We will be discussing the 1973 Al Pacino movie Serpico.
That's right. List of shame for me.
And me.
And I as well.
Oh, that's First Time Watchers podcast, because we like to watch.
The timeline? Yeah. Why did you
I just want to make sure you can see it okay.
Yeah.
How do I sound now?
You sound good.
I sound good.
I think we both sound good.
So the Jack Reacher trailer that you wanted to talk about originally.
Second one, yep.
I still think that's like the best music I've heard in a trailer in recent
history. I can't remember the music that's in it. All I can remember from that trailer is...
Oh, yeah. But that's tied with the music, though. With the end of the music. Oh.
So how do you feel about calling an adopted Chinese guy a communist?
That's pretty good.
That was... You're like, oh, what do you want to go?
Technically, it's true.
Why don't you go wave your flag or something? Then I see Kyle texts or writes back. What? He's got the weird face, like a dual listener.
Oh, I didn't
thing,
even Tim's. Notice. He was supposed to send.
He did it.
He'd send an email.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I forgot what he said. What his response was, and I said, "No, don't pay attention to me. He calls me a communist all the time." And he's like, "It is actually kind of ironic. I was adopted from China." I was like, "Oh, I got to give Tim help for this one."